In her latest novel, The Great Believers, Illinois writer Rebecca Mackay looks back on the AIDS outbreak in Chicago in the 1980s, including the question of whether or not people should be tested.
It's 1985. There is no medication. There's nothing. There's nothing even ameliorative, right? So do you want to know this?
Plus, you might be hoping to get outside now that summer's here in Illinois. There's perhaps no better destination than Starved Rock State Park. But it's gotten so popular that park officials are having a hard time maintaining everything, says Superintendent Kerry Novak.
It's a great feeling to know that this place is so popular and people obviously enjoy it and want to come back and everything like that. It's frustrating when you see the amount of use the place gets and, you know, the wear and the tear.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicago was one of the last American cities to experience the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. That time during the 1980s is the subject of a novel that's just out this week. It's been lauded by Entertainment Weekly, People Magazine, and the queen of book recommendations, even Oprah. Its author, Rebecca Mackay, is from Lake Forest. Her Chicago launch for the book is actually next Tuesday at Women and Children First Bookstore if you're in the area. But she's with me here now on the 21st. We spoke from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Rebecca, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on being featured in Oprah's magazine. It's a great thing for a writer, I would think.
That is a fantastic thing. Yeah, the magazine coverage is the one thing coming out right now. We're talking before the book is out. And the glossy magazines, those are really fun because those are the magazines you've been reading your whole life. So seeing your book in or Time or whatever is a pretty big trip.
So, Rebecca, I think this book is a really incredible exploration of the AIDS epidemic in Chicago. And there's so many people, I think, nowadays who are living with HIV and AIDS. And then we sort of have, I think, forgotten, or at least I certainly had, what it was like in the beginning. I wanted to ask you first, so why you chose to write this as a fictional account, as a novel?
Well, I only write fiction. So, you know, this is my fourth book. I've had two novels and a story collection. This was really a matter of following the characters into this plot. I started actually writing a novel that was focused elsewhere. There's what's now a really minor subplot in there about the art world in Paris in the 20s and a woman who's elderly now but has some artist sketches of herself. And it started with her, and then I followed her to this development director for a gallery actually at Northwestern, although I fictionalized the gallery, who would be working with her, and it became his story. So it was a very fictional path for me into the story. That said, as I researched, and I did a lot of research for this, because although it's fiction, it was really important for me to get the details right, I was astonished to find what a dearth there is of written information or even film information about Chicago in specific in the AIDS crisis. Everything out there is about New York and San Francisco, maybe LA. So someone, not me, someone with some serious nonfiction chops does, I think, need to write the big volume of Chicago's journey through AIDS and response to it.
How many years did you spend researching this before you started writing?
You know, I didn't research necessarily before I wrote. I researched as I wrote. And all told, it was 5 years of both research and writing. A lot of, you know, spending a day researching, maybe spending a day writing, maybe writing and leaving a few blanks. You know, I need them to go to a bar. I don't know what bar yet. I'm just going to leave it blank. Then emailing my friends and saying, you know, who were here in the 80s in Boys Town and saying, gosh, if it's this kind of bar, where would they go? But I did a lot of primary source research. There was a lot of holding up in the Harold Washington Library downtown and reading every back issue of the Windy City Times, Chicago's biggest gay weekly, from 1985 to 1992. But there was also, more importantly to me, a great deal of time that I spent sitting down with people who largely had lived here in Boys Town in the 80s, some of them, you know, having been diagnosed in the early 80s, still living with HIV. Others maybe who came to the city a little bit later but could speak to other parts of my story. I spoke to doctors, nurses, lawyers, activists, journalists, historians, survivors. It wasn't just factual research for me. It was emotional research. I really feel like the psychology and the tone of what they were saying to me suffuses the book.
And there is so much of this in the book. And before we get to all of that, particularly all of the emotion and the shame and all of the that's expressed in the book, I just wanted to ask you about what you're not old enough to have lived through this.
No.
So what did you know of this time before you started doing this?
Right. No, I'm being pretty open with the fact I was born in 1978. So I was a kid. And I was growing up largely in the suburbs. This was not a part of my world. I think my parents lost one colleague to AIDS, but I didn't really know much about it. I do think, though, for people right around my age, that you grow up understanding or feeling like this was a really massive, important thing that was going on. And we didn't have that long-term perspective of having lived through other crises. And we, at least for me, I didn't have that distance that a lot of adults might have had of that's happening over there to other people and maybe coming up with some kind of reason, in quotes, that they felt like it was happening over there. I was a kid, so I would see this on the news, or, you know, it was the TV generation. I saw way too much, but I, you know, stay home from sick from school and watch Donahue or whatever, and was absorbing all that. My understanding certainly grew as I got older, especially my understanding of the politics surrounding AIDS and the ways that certain politicians, actually most politicians, and our insurance companies and parts of our medical community really made this a much bigger issue than it had to have been. And that understanding, although I had that at the beginning, I didn't have the sort of granular understanding that I would get through these detailed interviews with people and really looking at not just the medical issues, you know, specific symptoms, specific medications, insurance issues, and the very specific history of what happened in Chicago.
My guest is Rebecca Mackay. Her most recent novel is called The Great Believers. As we're talking about this account of Chicago at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, this is even before, and you write about this, this is even before or right around the time it's hard to think about this. There was a time before there was even a test.
Yeah.
So this is around the time that they're actually just developing a test.
Right.
They're not really quite clear how good the test is. There seems to be a lot of conversation about that.
Yeah. So I'm starting the story in 1985, which is a year that I sort of originally picked at random. And I thought I'm going to see exactly what's going on in 1985. Happens to be when Windy City Times began publication. So that was very convenient for me. But as soon as I got into 1985, I realized it was exactly the right time to start, because it is the year that what we'd now call the HIV test, at the time it was, they were referring to it as HTLV-3. It was the year that test was approved, but was not necessarily available everywhere. And for instance, the Howard Brown Clinic here in the city didn't offer it until that winter. Certain doctors were offering it, though. And there were a lot of questions. The medical community was really confident that it worked. And in fact, it did. But people in general weren't sure that that was the case. There were also a lot of fears about results for this test possibly being subpoenaed in some way, or stolen by the government, used in really scary ways. And a couple of the doctors that I interviewed talked about using a coding system in their charts, little symbols, so that they never wrote down that someone had the virus, just in case. But even on top of that, there's the question of, it's 1985, there is no medication, there's nothing. There's nothing even ameliorative, right? So do you want to know this? It gets to be a political debate, even within the gay community. It gets to be a Rorschach test in many ways for people. What do you see when you look at this test? And do you want to know?
There's so much conversation about this. Should you be tested? Should you not? There are people who are thinking it's inevitable. If I'm a gay man in Chicago, I'm going to get AIDS. I'm going to die. Why should I know?
Right. And would it change the way I live? And if so, would it make my life better? Would it make it worse? And, you know, this is a pretty well-populated novel. I have a lot of characters because this is, you know, about a group of friends in Boys Town. And it was, for me in the writing, an early way to really differentiate my characters psychologically. Who feels what about this test, and who's going to get tested, and who says they would never do it? Who changes their mind later about that, too?
And to your point about divisions, and this novel, I think, is a lot about this, about divisions and divides between people. You alluded to this earlier. It was really remarkable for me to read how some members of the medical establishment dealt with this. That there were nurses who were afraid to go into rooms of patients who had AIDS because no one knew how people got it. There were doctors and hospitals that didn't know what to do with these gay men who were acquiring this. A lot of that is based in fact.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's huge disparity. And in Chicago, fortunately, one end of that was an absolutely incredible, actually a couple of incredible research units and AIDS units.
Illinois Masonic.
Illinois Masonic is the one that I specifically am writing about in the book. Unit 371 was the first dedicated AIDS unit in the country and became a model of compassionate AIDS care around the world. Northwestern did a lot of incredible research. There was great research happening at Cook County Hospital, but of course there were also major budget issues and a lot of other stuff going on there that I depict briefly. Meanwhile, you know, the first person who dies in my book, he's dead already at the beginning. It's his memorial service or memorial party. I'm not basing it on any particular place. I'm basing it on a general idea of what could happen. Was brought home by his parents to theoretically a very nice suburban hospital, and they're describing it as a hospital with beautiful wallpaper. You know, but that had. They had no idea how to deal with someone with this situation. They'd never had someone with AIDS in there before.
And that was happening.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of misinformation, even among nurses, even by that point, about how it might be spread. And certainly some actual alarm, nurses who, you know, stuck themselves with needles. And I've talked to at least two people for whom that was the case, that, you know, they accidentally stuck themselves and then had to go on AZT as they waited to find out if they'd been infected. That was later. But tremendous compassion and innovation and wonderful things going on one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, it's worse than you could imagine.
And to that point of the worst that you can imagine, the way that people die in this is just frankly, it's pretty agonizing. It's hard to read how people suffered. How hard was that to write?
It was very hard. You know, you have to love your characters if you're going to write them, and you have to almost develop this kind of delusion that they're real, really feel them as real physical presences. I also had this really, beyond the emotional struggle of now I have to kill off a character, which is horrifying, I had this really weird kind of psychological debate going on with myself about how within the book and within the world, especially of early AIDS, there's this question among people of why does one person die and another survive, and their sense of, you know, God might come into
that. One person contract the disease and another person doesn't?
Right. And questions of, you know, is it behavior-based? Is it health-based? Is it genetic? Is it God? Is it something else? And they're tortured by these questions. And then I, as the author, found myself in the very weird position of deciding who got the disease. And what does that mean about who I chose to be infected and who died and who didn't? And I spent a lot of time working with that. I think it was a helpful crisis for me to be having. But I found myself in this position of being almost this horrible combination of, you know, deity and political figure and arbiter of who lives and who dies in a way that I think people could and the time imagine there was up in the sky. And here I am being that thing, which was awful. I do want to say it was really important to me to show the slow progression of this virus. I think so often in particularly movies about AIDS, but I think it happens in books as well. And individually, I have no problem with these, but when you take it as a collective, I think it's problematic. So often, characters die dramatically offstage. We often have, for instance, in a movie, the scene of someone collapsing in public in a grocery store, in the courtroom, right? Tom Hanks collapsing in the courtroom in Philadelphia. And then they die either offstage or kind of very quietly, or their friend goes into the hospital room to visit them and the bed is empty. And I think, I don't want to speak negatively about any one piece of art, because I think for any one piece of art, that might be the right decision. But it bothered me as I was thinking about this, that we don't have as much that does look directly at the progression of the disease that really shows how long it took and how much people went through getting all the way to the end.
What was it like to immerse yourself? It was this world of death and dying.
Yeah. The thing is, I don't think it felt like that. I think there's a lot of life and joy in my characters. And I think there was a lot of life and joy in this community at this time. And as I sat down and talked with people, so often we'd end up laughing together about individual stories, about their friends, or just hearing about Unit 371 at Illinois Masonic, which seemed like, against all odds, an incredibly joyful place. They had Broadway posters on all the walls. They had restaurants donating food every night. They had, you know, a fish tank in the lounge. They had an art room. And obviously people are in pain there. There's a tremendous amount of suffering, but there's, you know, also hope, and there's also compassion and community. And honestly, entertaining stories, fun things that happened that I'm being told about, you know, jokes people played on each other, whatever, whether it's there or elsewhere. And I think that Chicago in specific, and I really mostly mean the community in Chicago, had a better grassroots response to AIDS than a lot of other cities. For one thing, we had more time to prepare. It really hit the hardest here a couple of years after it hit hard in San Francisco and New York. So there's something going on there. It might have been the size of the gay community in Chicago, the geographic centrality in Boys Town. But there are some amazing stories out there, some of which I tried to get in and some of which I didn't. But I had a wonderful time actually writing about these characters, even as they were going through hell. They're fun, beautiful, funny people.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Rebecca Mackay. She's the author of The Great Believers. It's out now, a new novel that charts the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in Chicago. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Rebecca Mackay. She's a Chicago author, and her latest novel is called The Great Believers. It's an epic account of the beginning of the AIDS epidemic and crisis in the Chicago area. A fictional account, as she's been telling us, of all of these different characters. Rebecca, I wonder what it was also like to... I think you do. There's so many gay men in the story, obviously, and you're really it's an interesting thing to be. I wonder how it was to be a straight woman and writing from a perspective of gay men.
Yeah, it gave me pause. I really, as much as I feel like I know that community and those people very intimately just from my own life, I really did think a lot about that line between allyship and appropriation and that question of whether I have the right to approach a story like this. One of the ways I dealt with that is the 1980s Chicago is only one of two timelines in the story. We're also in 2015 Paris with a straight woman, a little bit more like me, who lost her brother and some of her best friends back at that time, and she's tracking down her estranged daughter. So broadening the novel helped me, I feel, to make it seem, at least to me, less like an act of ventriloquism trying to take over this one perspective, and more like I was writing about a well-populated, busy world. But ultimately, for me, I decided in the middle of this that I needed to be able to answer two questions for myself satisfactorily. And the first was whether I could do this well. And while that's not up to me to say whether I accomplished that or not, my answer was, I think I can with the right research, which is why I spent so long researching in such depth, and also had quite a few people read it after it was done who could call me out on life in Boys Town, living with HIV, the medical parts of things, legal things. And I had people really giving me notes about things like the stickiness of the floor of a certain bar. It got to that level. I'm sure that I still have, you know, things in there that someone might remember differently, but I sure tried my best. The second question I really needed to answer was, does publishing this preclude other people from telling their stories? Or do I have a platform to amplify more, you know, direct first-person accounts of the AIDS crisis? And I really believe it's the latter. You know, the way publishing works, publishers are more, not less likely, if my book is successful, to publish something a year from now that's an account of the AIDS crisis or a novel or, you know, nonfiction about LGBTQ communities like this. I also, as I'm, you know, doing interviews, as I'm going on tour, I'm able to direct people to, you know, either memoirs or novels. So I've been directing a lot of Chicago people to the graphic novelist M.K. Cherwick's graphic memoir, Taking Turns, which is about her time as a charge nurse on Unit 371 at Masonic. I've also been directing people to art made by writers like Rabi Alameddine, who is HIV positive and writes about that community, that life in fiction, but is producing some beautiful art.
And then you do have characters like Fiona, who is one of the central characters of the book. And I think it's also another interesting component of this, which is the guilt that family members had who lived alongside these men who were dying.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this novel in survivor's guilt, along with a lot of other types of guilt. You know, there's a gap of 30 years there. We're going back and forth with every chapter between the 80s and 2015. And Fiona's not the only one who's left around in 2015. There are also several gay men, some of whom never got the virus and some of whom did. And in those cases, people who sometimes really had come to terms back 30 years ago with the fact that they were about to die and then did not. That is, I'm going to call it a mind trip because this is radio, but that's a mind trip that I spent a lot of time really digging into the psychology of that. With Fiona, you know, she was cast in this role that a lot of women who were closely attached to gay communities, whether they were straight women or lesbians, were cast into, of being tireless caregivers again and again and again, in a way that feels pretty similar to living through a war. And that comparison is made in the novel, having lost friends again and again and again, and having to completely repress the grief over that. And what's happening with Fiona 30 years later is that because of what life is throwing at her right then in Paris, it's all coming up at once in a way she can't control.
And there is an interesting allusion between the time differences, but also what you were talking about, the genesis of the book, this whole idea of a lost generation. And artists, then this is part of the book as well, artists that were lost to World War I in that post-war era, and what was lost here.
Right. So Yale Tishman, my main character, as I said, he's the development director for this art gallery. And what's going on in his professional life, which is going very well, even as everything else falls apart, is that this elderly woman, who's actually Fiona's great aunt, has come to him and said, I was an artist's model in Paris in the 20s, and I have all these sketches of myself by very famous artists. He's working against a lot of different factors there to make sure that they are authentic, then to make sure he can get them. And meanwhile, becomes quite close to this woman who's talking to him about World War I era Paris. I saw really interesting parallels there with right before World War I, it was the first time when really from all around Europe and even from America, young artists were traveling to Paris alone to study. And we get this school of painting called the École de Paris. So we get people like Soutine coming from Russia and Modigliani coming from Italy, coming all over very young, learning, studying. And then World War I comes and completely interrupts this community of friends that they've built for themselves in what had been this Mecca. Not only World War I, but then the influenza, which kills a lot of them off. And she's talking then about coming back into Paris after World War I and trying to figure out who was still alive. Those parallels were really fascinating to me and are at the forefront of the book. And in fact, the title of the book, The Great Believers, comes from an F. Scott Fitzgerald quote that I've used as my epigraph, where he's talking about the lost generation in Paris. We tend to use lost generation more when we're talking about the writers, I guess. But same time, same people, maybe coming a little bit later for Fitzgerald getting to Paris. But that generation that had maybe, you know, fought in the war, saw all this loss very, very young, and then tried to put their lives back together afterwards.
And that parallel, there's a comment in the book that reminds us that AIDS is still very much a crisis in other countries, particularly when we're thinking about the African continent. Do you think we've forgotten about that?
Very much. Fiona is thinking about this in her sections and thinking about the fact that 1 million people a year still die of AIDS. And I've had several early readers of the book tell me that they had to Google that because they were sure that I must be wrong. That is absolutely right. And at the same time, we also have around 1 million people living with HIV in America. And this is at a time when, you know, Trump has cut the last remaining governmental resources for HIV, that agency, and is pulling out of help in Africa. You know, Fiona actually spends some time thinking about why it's not at the forefront of her mind, these people dying in Africa, the way it was when it was her brother and his friends, and is, you know, kind of calls herself out on it in a way that's, I think, partly me calling myself out on it. I do tend to think of AIDS, or maybe did, you know, more before I did this research, tended to think of it as something of the past. And as I talk to people about what my new book is about, I'll often get comments. I haven't even told them that it's 1980s Chicago. I've just said, well, it's about the AIDS epidemic. And I'll get a lot of, oh, I remember that time. I know what they mean. So I'm gentle when I call them out on it. But we need to keep talking about this. And I'm really excited to be doing, for the next couple of months, a donation campaign. There is a food pantry here in Chicago. It's actually sort of a mini grocery store called Vital Bridges. It's in Edgewater. And actually, if you read my book, towards the end, someone makes a reference to an organization called Open Hand. This is someone who's going home from the hospital. And he says Open Hand was already over there stocking my fridge, which is what they would do. They would do meal delivery. Now they have transformed into this place called Vital Bridges. And it really is this grocery store. It's a beautiful place. And the woman who runs it is the activist Lori Cannon, who's been at the forefront of things in Chicago since the 80s and was a huge research help on my book. So I'm trying to give back to, you know, the Chicago AIDS community and to that organization in specific. And what we're doing is, you can find the information on my website, which is RebeccaMackay.com. If you take a photo of the book with the hashtag The Great Believers Donate and put that on Twitter or Instagram, I will donate $1 to Vital Bridges. And I also have some bookstores helping me with matching donations, which I'm very excited about.
Rebecca Mackay, his most recent book is called The Great Believers. It's out now. If you're in the Chicago area, you can see her at Women and Children First bookstore in Andersonville next Tuesday evening at 7:00. Rebecca, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It was a long and cold winter here in Illinois, but at long last, the sun's out and trees have bloomed, and maybe you're hoping to get outside, especially now that school's out. Starved Rock State Park is probably one of the first places that comes to mind. But if you're planning on visiting, you're far from the only one. Site Superintendent Carrie Novak recently checked in on how many people have visited Starved Rock since 2014, and the answer was 10.4 million people. All of that's taking a toll on the park's physical landscape. Carrie Novak is the site superintendent of Starved Rock and Matheson State Parks. Tom Collins is a reporter with the LaSalle News Tribune in the Illinois Valley. We spoke earlier. I started by asking Superintendent Novak about how all of that foot traffic affects the trails.
When you have a couple of million visitors, and I think last year we had 2.7 million visitors, 2.8, probably the majority of them are using the trails, enjoying the trails, that just puts a lot of wear and tear on them. They're, you know, it's a basically the rocks and the bluffs and everything here are sandstone, so that's a fairly fragile stone, and it does wear down.
And what other kind of impact are you seeing from the amount of traffic on the landscape of Starved Rock?
The trails are getting a lot of use. The other thing is, too, the physical features of the trail that we've installed, for example, stairways, walkways, decks, and things like that, also take a tremendous beating in this and require a great deal of maintenance and upkeep. And we have a couple of bridges that are closed and need to be replaced, and that type of thing.
Tom, you reported on these numbers, as I mentioned, for the LaSalle News Tribune. Based on your reporting, was there an anticipation of the amount of numbers that Kerry has uncovered, the 10.4 million people over the past couple of years?
2 years ago, the answer would have been yes. In 2016, the National Park Service celebrated their centennial, and everyone knew that all of our state parks from coast to coast would see an increase in visits, and indeed that was the case. At the end of 2016, we thought, okay, Starved Rock had a record year. We will see the numbers retreat. They didn't. We broke 5 monthly records in 2017 and finished with a new record, just over 2.8 million. It was actually just a 2% jump from the National Parks record year in 2016. But those few thousand people make a big difference. To put this in perspective, Starved Rock outdraws all but 10 of the U.S. national parks. You know the names: Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone. Those are the only parks in the country, 10 of them, that draw more people than Starved Rock. Our park was not meant for that type of punishment.
And Kerry, do you restrict the amount, like those parks, they're counting people coming in, they're restricting traffic. Is that something you might think about doing?
We have been to the point that on weekends, when we begin filling, we start, you know, closing lots as they come in. And we have, unfortunately, just about every weekend had to, and especially the major holidays, had to close the park for, you know, a couple hours in midday, just simply because everything was full.
Wow. So, Kerry, for folks that might want to come, what's your advice to them as they're thinking about planning their trips this summer?
Hopefully, they can come during the week, Monday through Friday. This is really a wonderful experience. The trails are spectacular. The views, the canyons, and everything here, I think people will just love it. If you come on a weekend, maybe try to get here early and be patient with us. We're doing our best.
Tom, I imagine this has also had a pretty significant economic impact on the surrounding area, the amount of folks that are coming.
It cuts both ways. It certainly has brought some money into the area. However, the village of North Utica, which is immediately located outside the Starved Rock boundaries, has not benefited directly. You would think that during a record attendance year, Utica's coffers would fill proportionally. Not quite that simple. And unfortunately for the village, there are some logistical problems created by Starved Rock's popularity. The traffic is bad. The first responders worry about being able to get to ambulance calls when Route 178 is bumper to bumper. And additionally, Utica's mostly volunteer ambulance service is needed when there's an accident at Starved Rock. And obviously, whenever the overall population or attendance increases, accidents happen. It's a lot of work for our first responders.
And Tom, is there a sense that the town is trying to hopefully add more resources, or is there an ability to do that?
It's hard to say because the two agencies, the Department of Natural Resources and the Village of Utica, do work well together, but of course they're funded in completely different ways. Utica certainly can't, you know, command dollars for to respond to accidents that happen within park territory. Now, what I'm hearing from the people in Utica is they think the time is coming, if not already come, for there to be entrance fees. And I don't think we're talking about the types of dollars that one would have to pay at a U.S. national park. But even an admission fee of a few dollars would create a revenue stream, maybe give the staff an opportunity to do some projects, and maybe even to temper the number of visits on the weekends that have become so problematic for Kerry and his overworked staff.
I want to thank Tom Collins from LaSalle News Tribune for reporting on this issue. We'll tweet out his story. Kerry Novak for joining us as well, site superintendent for Starved Rock and Matheson State Park, giving us some good advice. If you want to go this summer, do not go on the weekend. Go during the week. Thanks, gentlemen. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, we heard earlier about the huge numbers of visitors to Starved Rock State Park. In fact, 10.4 million people have visited the park in the last 4 years, and that's been taking a toll on the natural landscape of the park. And it's been leading park officials like site superintendent Carrie Novak to encourage folks to visit during the week. And of course, now that it's officially summer, school's out, certainly more people will want to get outside and visit some of our outdoor attractions. If Starved Rock, even Matheson State Park, seem too crowded for you, what are some off the beaten path destinations, and what can be done to make some of these more popular tourist attractions a little more manageable for everybody? Nuno Ribeiro is an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the University of Illinois. I spoke with him from our Urbana studios last month. Welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get to some of your suggestions, we were just hearing earlier about Starved Rock and how it's certainly one of the most well-known tourist destinations.
The most well-known destination in the state.
And how much a risk of overcrowding it is. Do you think that's the only example, or do you think this happens at other parts of the state as well?
We have a few other examples. Close to the Shawnee National Forest, the Garden of the Gods, some other areas near the northwest border of the state, where Iowa are also heavily visited. The Great River Roads has some periods during the year also heavily visited. But I think Starved Rock really is the prime example, just because of the sheer numbers.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's just because we know one or two places and people, it's sort of like our Disney World. Everyone's like, let's just go there.
That's certainly part of the explanation. I think it's a combination of factors. They've become very well known. It's by far the most well-known attraction in the state. You also have an older population that is leading far healthier and more active lifestyles. So they're more likely to visit. Social media has played a role. You know, that's selfie country, right?
Right, it's Instagram land there.
It's eminently Instagrammable. You know, all those selfies with the cascading water behind you, you know, they create a desire for tourists to go. The fact that we also have a renewed interest in the outdoors. You know, people want to experience the outdoors. And finally, as I think the last couple of seasons have proved exemplarily, we have very rigorous winters. So if you're cooped up inside your house for months at a time, and all of a sudden it's nice and sunny outside, what do you want to do? You want to go out and enjoy the outdoors. And typically, the ones that are more in the foremost of your mind, well, I've heard of this, I want to go visit this park. So obviously, everyone has had the same idea.
And is there a fix to this? Is it a matter of staffing, or if there were more people?
There isn't a silver bullet. There are some actions that we can take both as tourist academics, tourist practitioners, members of the media, and members of the public that we can do. Among them, first and foremost, to inform and educate visitors. You know, call ahead. Look at the social media presence of these different sites. You're going to find a section somewhere that says, you know, peak times are... And I understand it doesn't work for everyone's schedule, but just that phone call, hey, how's the park looking? Or if you're driving there, a good rule of thumb, you know, if the overflow lots are 2/3 full, I might drive to the next destination.
If you have to wait in line just to get into the parking lot, it's not a good sign, right?
It's not a good sign. And obviously, we want you to visit. I don't want to discourage visitors by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, we want you to have a good time. We want you to experience the park. We want you to experience nature as it's meant to be in its pristine state. And at the same time, we don't want any permanent damage to what is a beautiful, beautiful part of the country.
And it's a conundrum a little bit, right? Because
it certainly is.
I think we love to go to outdoor attractions. And I think when there's so many, when you're in a place like a national park and there's so many other people, sometimes that kind of kills the point of being there. Doesn't it? It does.
It kind of kills the joy of being there. You know, the loneliness of the outdoors, the quiet enjoyment of nature, certainly. So what else can we do?
Right. So let's get to the education, because you have a list of other places that we could go
to. I'm only going to mention one or two. I'm thinking of the patience of our listeners. We want to encourage visitors to stay tonight. We live in a state where it's easy and it's comfortable to drive just about anywhere within a day. So what happens is that in a 24-hour period, you're going to have peak times between 10 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the evening. Well, guess what? Everyone else has had the same idea. So how about instead of just going for the day, just plan that two-day getaway, maybe during the week, play hooky. I didn't say that. If the dean or provost is hearing, I'd never say that. But spend 2 days rather than one. We want to turn excursionists, those who only visit for a day, into tourists. It's great for the local economy. It's going to be great for you. You have that lovely breakfast using farm fresh, naturally sourced products from the local farm. You wake up bright and early, and then you visit the attraction, and then you are a lot more relaxed. You're going to enjoy the park or the natural area in its pristine shape. We also want to regulate, and now I'm speaking more to practitioners, we want to regulate the number of visitors. There is a point beyond when we're coming very, very close to the carrying capacity of a natural area where we say, well, look, we're going to allow X number of visitors per hour. And it may come a point, I mean, and I think the Starved Rock may be getting there where we actually limit the number of visitors. Where we say, no, beyond this point, we can't allow more visitors per day. We just...
Do they do that, for example, like, do they do that at the Grand Canyon?
They do. They do. Certainly. They do it in a variety of national parks. In fact, all 10 of the most visited national parks, they all have those regulations. They count the number of visitors every day.
Of cars that are coming in.
Cars, and now they've gotten to the point where they count the number of people, especially if the trails are being used, because the heavy usage of the trail gets to a certain point where you actually have to limit, you know, say that we have 5,000 people or 4,000 people in the park. Beyond that, the damage done becomes irreversible or becomes very costly to reverse. Mm-hmm. We also want to turn visitors into volunteers. Do you love that park? Awesome. You know what? Donate your time. Donate your effort. And your appreciation, the time that you're going to have to actually enjoy that park is going to be even better.
So what do you mean by that, by volunteers?
We have a immense deficit in knowledgeable staff in our natural areas. You know, DNR is certainly doing the very best that they can, but they're short-staffed. So if you live close to a natural area that you enjoy, maybe you can lead that high school tour. You know, maybe you can donate your time and welcome visitors and show them perhaps your favorite part of the park. And all of that is most welcome. And what that does is it gives the visitor an insight that didn't necessarily have. It turns them into advocates for these natural areas. And that grows into the old part of educating visitors and making them aware that these natural resources, they are here for our enjoyment, certainly. But we're not really owners of the land. We're more like stewards, right? And we obviously want to preserve that enjoyment, not just for us, but for future generations.
My guest is our unofficial tour guide to all things Illinois, Nuno Ribeiro, who teaches in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the U of I. He's here with me in Urbana to talk about a couple other locations. And there are two in particular that are pretty renowned that don't get as much attention even as Starved Rock.
That's right. Absolutely.
Let's start with Cahokia.
So Cahokia Mounds is the site of the largest pre-Columbian settlement in North America. It is magnificent. It's one of the 26 World Heritage Sites granted by UNESCO to the United States. And although it's very famous, the number of visitors is actually quite small.
So before we get to what it's like when you go there, can you tell us a little bit more about what we know about the people of Cahokia? Because that's a bit of a mystery, right?
It is. I mean, we have tidbits of information. So it's at the confluence of certain bodies of water. So it makes that land extremely fertile. And it also makes it ideal for
transport. Can you remind us which bodies of water?
The Mississippi, the Illinois, and the Missouri rivers. So obviously, the confluence of these three bodies of water make not only the land eminently fertile and attractive to populations at that period, but it makes it a great point of communication between different tribes. And what we had was basically an incredibly evolved society. This is in pre-Columbian times that developed these types of structures or mounds that were used for a variety of things, from observation to burial sites and whatnot. And it just flourished. And somehow we think it might be a little bit related to a flood that might or might not have occurred. It might have happened something with intertribal warfare.
So this is like 1,500 years ago?
Just about.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, it sort of kind
of just
disappeared. Not quite overnight, but it's almost something like it of the X-Files, which is really, really interesting for historians and tourism academics such as myself. But it's worth the visit. The amount of history contained in that particular site is just absolutely incredible.
Now, your one caveat is it's a kind of a hard thing to visit on your own without someone who knows about it.
Please stop by the visitor center and take the tour. Otherwise, it's just going to look like a bunch of hills. Very beautiful hills, as far as the eye can see, magnificent, yes. But you need to read a little bit to really understand and recognize the historical importance of that particular site.
And it would be actually, and I know as we think about, we've done past conversations about Cahokia and having people there, it certainly would help to have a lot more people visiting this area knowing more about it.
It would help immensely, absolutely. It's an area that certainly could use it.
Another location you have that's kind of on the opposite end of a spectrum from ancient ruin, even though there's nothing there, is a garden.
Right. So the Anderson Japanese Gardens are magnificent. This is in Rockford, Illinois. They're one of my favorite destinations. And just in case you don't know, they have one of the most beautiful outside tea houses that I've seen in my lifetime. They're absolutely magnificent. The garden themselves, they're just this oasis of tranquility. And who should perform the tea ceremonies when they do occur in a tea house? Our very own delightful staff from right here at Japan House at UIUC. So here's a plug for them.
Okay.
You should definitely go visit them. They are magnificent gardens. And part of the gardens are ADA accessible, which is fairly uncommon in North America.
So you're saying that that...
If you are mobility impaired, if you necessitate the use of a walker or of a wheelchair, there are parts of the garden that were built specifically with that in mind so that you can enjoy that specific part of the gardens.
And why do you think people don't know as much throughout the state? And I think our listeners in the Rockford area probably would know a lot more about Anderson Japanese Gardens versus other parts of the state or Cahokia. Do you think it's because they don't get as much social media attention
it
or
might
conversation?
Be. I mean, you know, they're, again, eminently Instagrammable. I know that the most number of likes that I ever got in my Instagram feed was when I took a photo in the Anderson Japanese Gardens. But it might be just because they're known only to a select group of people within a certain geographic radius. It might be because of that.
And then getting to the idea of other hikes or other state parks, we know Shawnee National Forest, we know Starved Rock. What are some other parks throughout the state that people can think about visiting
this summer? The Mississippi Palisades State Park in Savannah, Illinois, that's in the northwest Illinois near the border with Iowa, is just beautiful. Literally, you are likely to have the park to yourself, maybe not after this radio talk, but it is absolutely beautiful. It's fairly unknown to most of the Illinois public. There's about 10 to 15 miles of trails that you can hike. It's absolutely gorgeous. Another area is the Cache River Natural Area. This is in Belknap, Illinois.
This is near
Shawnee, right. And what a lot of people don't know, typically when we hear about the Shawnee National Forest, we think the Garden of the Gods, but there's a host of other local parks. So if you've taken the day and you're set on seeing the Garden of the Gods and you get there, you know, and maybe there's a lot of cars, you know, the overflow parking lot is full or close to full, you know what? Drive a couple of miles, see one of these other parks, stay the night, and then bright and early the next morning, then go visit a Garden of the Gods for sure.
Also in southern Illinois, you have another location near Carbondale.
I do. I have the Pomona Natural Bridge in Pomona, Illinois, which is absolutely beautiful. It's not the name of the park, but it's how you'll get there. If you ask for that, it says rock formation. It's basically a 14-foot natural bridge. Again, for those of you who are on social media, this is the best selfie you can possibly get in your lifetime. And lastly, the Grandview Drive, which is a half-mile stretch of road that goes through Peoria Heights in Peoria, Illinois, and that is absolutely beautiful. And you wouldn't know it's there. It's sort of tucked away, and you have to punch it in your GPS, Grandview Drive, and if you drive too fast, you're going to miss it. It forces you to slow down, to appreciate nature, to appreciate your surroundings, and there's nothing but park benches scattered here and there.
So a couple, we'll have a list. Nuno has created this great list for us. We will have this list on our website at 21stshow.org. We will tweet out this list as well. So with Cahokia Mounds, Anderson Japanese Garden, then a couple state parks in a couple areas. We will have all of this at our website so you can remember them. Maybe we'll have, Nuno, maybe we should put your Instagrams of these on our website.
Sure.
I want to thank Nuno Ribeiro with the University of Illinois Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism for being with us. Thanks for being
My
here.
My absolute pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple. You download it, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to our past programs that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. Search for the 21st to like us, and you can comment on what we're working on, or you can send us messages, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All these links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. When you get to that page, just navigate over to the right. It's got all of our contact information there. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.